Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to The Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episode 2 of the team's latest series on The State versus Jason Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and do that before listening on. So joining us on this episode are Sarah Kalin. She was a police officer and sex crimes detective for 10 years before going into academic research in the area of criminal psychology with a concentration on serial sexual predators and serial homicide. She works now as a civilian consultant for police agencies as well as nonprofits and private entities investigating cold case homicides and rapes, particularly those with serial features. She also specializes in cases involving domestic violence. Sarah hosts a series of speaking engagements across the country. Sarah, thanks for coming on The Addendum.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk today.
And we have somebody, I think it's her name is Rabia
Chaudhry.
Okay. Rabia Chaudhry is the lead investigator of this case. One of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast. And I always feel like, why am I even saying that? Because everybody knows who you
just
are.
Just say Robbie is here.
Robbie is in the house, everybody. So we had episode 2, and we started off in I thought, two really interesting ways. Before we get to the discussion of victimology, because it's really important. Robbie, you've come out as a fan of Only Murders in the Building.
Also really important, yes.
Also really important. First of all, can I just ask, like, you explain why you like it. Are you still enjoying it? I love that show for all the reasons, right?
Yeah. Last night, I committed the cardinal sin. My husband was working on it because an episode came out yesterday, and we usually watch, you know, at night when the kids are asleep. My husband was working on a puzzle, and I'm like, I'm not waiting anymore. And I just started without him. And as soon as the music started playing, he ran out. He's like, what are you doing? So that's how much I like it. I'll watch it without him if he takes too long. No, I love it. I love it. I think it's quirky, funny, smart, witty. Also, we're wondering who killed Tim Kono, and it's just kind of spot on without being condescending, you know, about those of us who do this work. So I really like it. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the reasons you talked to it is there was the discussion about the quote unquote episode 2, which everybody has obviously, and they'll often focus on the victim there. And there was a really funny quote between Martin Short and Steve Martin. And here's your episode 2. Felt like, I mean, quite seriously, this is the moment to explain more about Sharon's life and then how it plays into the bigger picture. Yes, no?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, like, you know, when I saw that quote, I laughed. And when I was watching that episode of the series, I laughed. And then I was like, wait, let me just hold a second. Let me just go back and look. I pulled up my phone and I went back through the series, some of the series I produced. And I'm like, oh yeah, episode 2 is. And then I looked at my outline, which, you know, I've had the outline for this case done like months ago. And I'm like, oh my God, I really did. But then I was like, is it really for the reasons they're saying? And I realized, from an investigative angle, that's actually not why you do it. Maybe in some shows that is, like, you know, it's to make people sympathetic and care more. But the Undisclosed team is trying to figure out what actually happened. And Sarah does a fantastic job explaining, like, you know, when she approaches a case, literally victimology is where she begins. That's how important it is. So I think that's really the reason that most episode 2s are about the victims. You got to figure out what's happening, like, in their lives.
Yeah, the science of it is called victimology. And I think that, Sarah, you do a good job sort of setting this up. This is not victim blaming, but it's very important in a lot of cases to have a clinical study of why a person was victimized. Why did the perpetrator target this person as opposed to that person? And why at this moment as opposed to the other moment? What do you often get? You know, people that just hear, oh, no, you're saying that she brought it upon herself.
I don't get that certainly in the work that I do, either in the media or obviously in an investigative capacity, because when I'm working on a case, I'm working with other professionals or other investigators who, you know, who are aware that, quite frankly, I mean, you just laid it out. Like, why was she where she was, when and with who? And if you're looking for an unknown perpetrator, those are the things that will help you work backwards to the person. Right. And so, no, I mean, I don't find, you know, other investigators or I think that the media work that I do, I tend to make it very clear from the outset that I approach all cases as a victim advocate, particularly cold cases, because for most of them, not all, some of them, it really is just bad luck or good planning on the criminal's part. But for the most part, in cold cases, the ones that I deal with, they're victims from marginalized communities. And there's a reason that there wasn't a ton of pressure on the authorities. And so it's really important to understand that person and understand not just the surface reasons of why they might have been somewhere or with who, but the real in-depth underlying stuff. And one of the things that Robbie and I talked about is that, you know, I mean, I'm working on a case right now where had I not begun my investigation with a 2-hour long phone call with her daughter, with the victim's daughter, I would not have identified the person that we're now probably going to be making an arrest of. Like, I would have never landed on this guy had I not had an in-depth conversation with her about friends in her circle, you know, and the original investigators never did, because she was a sex worker and they just assumed it was a, you know, it was drug deal related or sex work related rather than somebody actually in her intimate circle.
Right.
I apologize for the frantic animals.
We can always have a larger guest panel on addendum. Who's your dog in the background?
So that you hear,
because
two
I gotta
of them.
Say, I gotta say, this is a recurring theme this season. We get a lot of dogs and squeak toys and stuff like
keep
that.
Keep them in. I say,
keep them in. Yeah.
The dogs are George and Brennan, a corgi and a border collie. And I tried to put them downstairs with one of the kids who's home from school today, but the doorbell rang and all bets are off when the doorbell rang.
I don't want to walk away from this discussion of victimology, but there is a clip in this week's episode where the dog barks at himself, Rabia, and you keep it in.
It was so funny.
Oh my God.
It was so funny because when we're talking, you know, she turned, I think it was when I was talking to Lisa. Lisa was just like, oh, every time my dog sees her like reflection in the glass mirror, and it's not your mirror. It's actually like the glass, like sliding door.
Yeah.
She starts barking at herself. I'm like, that is so cute.
And on top of that, now we're fostering these kittens that my kids found dumped in a park. And so now we've got just kittens everywhere. Like it's just bananas in here. So I apologize. But so going back to it. So I personally haven't experienced pushback because I make it very clear when I discuss victimology that that's what I'm talking about in terms of, you know, in terms of the academic or the investigative language. Now, that being said, I've gotten yelled at on Twitter for simply using the word victimology by people who don't necessarily know my work. And I'm sure that Rabia has as well. You know, because people don't like so much about true crime. There is a lot that's really exciting about all of these lay people, you know, jumping in and learning and wanting to be more involved. But there are risks that come with that. And some of it is not having the breadth of knowledge to get the larger points, right? And so you hear a word like victimology and they're like, oh, so you're saying it's her fault? No, of course not. I mean, I wouldn't do the work I do if I believed that.
Yeah, I think the name of the area of study is almost like a misnomer, because you're right, it isn't about the behavior of the victim. It is about the behavior of the perpetrator and how he or she selects victims, right?
I would quibble with that. It is about the behavior of the victim, but it never in terms, you know, in official terms, it never says that that behavior warranted assault or warranted crime. It doesn't matter. You could walk down the middle of the worst street in the worst city without a strip of clothing on, and if you get sexually assaulted or murdered, I'm gonna like burn it to the ground finding out who did this to you, because nobody ever deserves that. Nobody ever asks for it. Nobody ever contributes to it. And I will not, I won't take that. But we do, the victimology really is the study of the victim, because then you know why the offender was interested in that victim. And then you know, who, it's easier to find out who they are if you know why.
Robbie, tell me a little bit about meeting and discussing this case with some folks who were in the family. I think you speak with Ken's daughter, his daughter, stepdaughter.
I talked to in this episode, I think it was Lisa is the one who, like, we have clips from, and Lisa was the daughter he adopted when he was married to his previous wife. And I think Lisa was just a few years old when he adopted her. So he was like the only father Lisa ever knew, and he raised her, and they mostly had, he was, I mean, from everything she had to say, she said he was great to me. She's like, I was a brat and I was a difficult child, like a teenager, and I gave him hell, but he never hit me. He was always really patient. And to be honest, even Sharon's daughter, who Melanie, who we'll hear from in the next episode, said similar things, that Ken was great, like fine as a father. They never felt intimidated by him or scared of him or anything like that. Other than that, I don't think there's any other family members from this episode that we hear from.
Yeah, because I think one thing that we always like to examine is what's going on inside the home leading up, you know, to the days before, or, you know, weeks and months and years before the crime, to see if there's a possibility that it's somewhat domestic related. And so as you're doing your research, can you tell us if there was anything there that stuck out to you or stuck out to the investigators at the time that say, okay, there's now we want to look inward and maybe not out at, you know, a random robbery?
Yeah. No, I mean, look, investigators from the jump were focused on Ken, and for all the right reasons. It was interesting to talk to people who knew Sharon and who knew Ken. A couple things that jumped out at me immediately were the fact that, like, everybody was friends with Sharon. Sharon seemed to have so many people who loved her and she was friendly with, and she made efforts to be connected to, she socialized with, she dropped by. So many people identified themselves as Sharon's best friend. That said a lot to me. I don't think I've come across a single statement in the entire file or have heard from anybody who called themselves Ken's friend, much less Ken's best friend. And everybody said the kind of same thing, that, you know, Sharon was incredible. She was warm, loving, caring, you know, and Ken was just like this somebody they had to kind of go along with because he was married to her and nobody liked him. But nobody also at the same, and numerous people said that they felt like they knew things were bad and that they had a lot of arguments. They also knew that they had a very active sex life. And I think this was just like a really kind of a, maybe even a troubling dynamic between them, like kind of like the fighting sex cycle. Like it just seemed like a daily thing for them. But nobody said that they knew anything about him ever hitting her, that she never told anybody that he ever hit her.
Right.
Nobody had ever witnessed him being violent ever. He didn't have any violent offenses in his past. Although his ex-wife did report that he threatened her, but not that he'd put his hands on her.
Right. Sarah, a lot of times people grieve in different ways. They react to tragedy in different ways. Can you tell me what red flags you heard about in the notification to Ken of Sharon's murder?
Yeah. And again, I would preface it by saying that I wasn't in the room. We can only take the word of the investigators who gave the notification.
Right.
And it's certainly not to say that detectives are always right. Obviously, we have a whole industry built on the fact that that's not the case. But what I found interesting from the reports of the initial notification was a sense of performance. And that to me is more alarming than whether somebody cries, whether somebody doesn't cry, you know, all of those things. You're right. People have very different ways of processing or emoting grief, especially. But performance is something that, I mean, most people can feel bad acting in the room. And that was something that they seemed to take from it. I know Rabia talked to Tom Sexton. I also separately, when I just on one of the trips up there, spoke at length with Tom Sexton. And while he wasn't present for the notification, he was present for the first interview. And he had a very intense sense of Ken simply not caring, which is very different from the types of things we think of in terms of like how somebody reacts if they cry or they don't cry. I mean, like when people interpret 911 calls or notifications, a lot of times the stuff they're fishing around at is what somebody says or how they say it and everything. I think an investigator saying, I couldn't understand why he didn't care. He was just not bothered. And we heard that from other people as well. I mean, we heard that from her friend who called and had to like beg him to call the police the morning she was missing. She said it just seemed like he didn't care. And that is more of a red flag to me than, you know, whether somebody cries or not.
Yeah. And he didn't seem to ask the question about, do you have any suspects? Are you going to get, you know, are you going to get some evidence? He did to have 1 minute there where it's almost like out of a, Hercule Poirot novel, where he may have made a slip up when he tells somebody that she was found nude, which was a detail that was not given to him by the police. So certainly this was something that the investigators picked up on right away. Is it still relevant to the examination of this case all this time later?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I would defer to Rabia. I consider this her case. She certainly knows the ins and out better than I do. But I think, you know, none of this to me, if we examine Ken as a suspect, feels like anything that was premeditated, you know, with a ton of forethought or a ton of planning. And so it always feels like at every step, he was kind of just cleaning up the last little mess. And that just feels like one more of those factors to me. Again, like on its own, you could find a way to excuse it, or you know, sweep it out of the picture. But all of these things start to add up and start to look like somebody who is just constantly trying to put out fires.
Sarah, there's a question that a couple of people raised online in relation to this very issue that Kevin's talking about. And I actually want to ask you, I'll defer to you on this, but I'm pretty sure I know the answer. People are like, well, what if they showed him photographs of the crime scene to identify her, which I believe would never be done. So maybe that's how he knew. So let me ask you, when the police routinely, like, what's the procedure in trying to get like a identification from a family member from a photo? Where's that photo taken? Would the police take a picture of the victim, let's say at the morgue versus the crime scene, or what's normal operating procedure here?
Right. I mean, I guess I can't say that it wouldn't ever happen, but I've certainly never seen it. And I can't imagine a situation where I would show the spouse of a deceased the crime scene photo for a couple of reasons. One, you're giving them information that you may need to withhold from them for the investigation.
Because they're a potential suspect.
Because at the very beginning, one, everybody's kind of a potential suspect. And two, you know, there's a reason we have the kind of the joke about the husband always did it, because, you know, most of the time he did. And so, you know, yeah, no, you're not going to show him the crime scene. You need to withhold stuff from that to verify, et cetera. But also too, just imagine how heartless you have to be to meet somebody and throw a picture of their dead spouse, their brutally murdered spouse in front of them. I can't see a scenario where that would happen. It would typically be, if anything, they would bring him to the morgue. Short of that, yes, then the medical examiner or sometimes a funeral director or somebody like who is specializes in this takes photos of the body, identifying marks or something like that, that the person can use to identify them. What, you know, one of my cases, it was because there was so much damage done to the body, they just took very close up photos of some of her tattoos. And that's what was given to the family.
Yeah. I also think that, you know, in this case, like, you know, the detective would not have noticed this was weird that he said that if he had just shown him a picture showing that. Right. I mean, like,
yeah.
Right. So the detective noted that he said that, which means that he had no way of knowing.
Right. Basically. Well, and, you know, devil's advocate there, I guess, after, you know, speaking with Tom Sexton, I know that there were different detectives who came in at different stages, even in that initial phase of the investigation. So I guess, you know, you could say it's entirely possible one detective.
These were the notifying detectives and they were together the entire time.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Like, I just can't see how in this particular circumstance, I guess sometimes I play defense attorney too, because I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to say, well, what could this person used to dispute my assertion? Or also on the flip side of that, am I sure I have the right person? So it's important to kind of play the defense team, you know, when I'm looking at somebody. But yeah, in this case, that doesn't seem to be plausible.
Does anybody have a theory, as I do, about why Ken Johnson went to get a newspaper that morning?
Oh, 100%. I think he was looking for news to see about whether or not the body had been found.
I mean, remember, it's the late 1980s, so people still did have newspaper subscriptions. So if he wasn't getting the morning paper every day,
he had to go get it.
The idea that today's the day I'm going to go out and get the newspaper would seem as, yeah, I mean, that would be my supposition, but I'm not a cop. And so, you know, with the
and also
that caveat,
it seems like what's the priority here? Your wife is missing. And you're like, I'm just going to go get a paper. Like, this is not like a Sunday morning with the family, right? Where maybe back in the day, we might have gone to get a paper just to hang out with the family. And you take the comics and I take the sports, whatever. This was a morning that his wife was missing and he goes to get a paper. So,
right. Yeah, rather than driving her route to work. I mean, if he was so
anything.
Sure that she came home, right. He should be driving her route to work. He should be, you know, yeah.
Calling people he knows, calling people she knows, right? He didn't call anybody.
No. Now, yeah, going to get the paper seems a bit silly. It's also, it's comical to me because it's something that we see characters in very bad thriller movies do. Right. You know what I mean? And like, oh, here's the serial killer in the movie and he's going to go see if there's anything about it in the paper. Like, oh, God.
Yeah, so this episode is called Noonies, and Robbie, while you're giving your narration in episode 2, you explain what that is and start off by also saying, normally we wouldn't include this, but it's really important. So remind us again what a noonie was.
Really, Kevin? You know, Thomas Sexton was shocked to learn what a noonie was. But, you know, basically, in this particular case, Ken and his wife Sharon had a habit of hooking up in the middle of the day during her lunch breaks. I don't know if it was an everyday thing. I don't know if it was a once a week thing when he went to pick up her paycheck. I don't know how often this happened. But from what Sexton understood was that it happened like every day or all the time, and maybe in a car, maybe in some random spot that was like hidden. And it was just kind of a lunchtime little dalliance, little tryst they had as part of their coupleship, I guess. And
afternoon,
you know,
delight. There's a whole song about it.
Yeah, afternoon delight. And so, you know, and I said, kind of, I briefly mentioned in the episode that their sex life comes up over and over again. A lot of people, when they were asked about like what were they like as a couple, said, well, I don't know about other stuff. Yeah, they argued this and that, but gosh, they were always getting it on. And Sharon was the one to tell people how active their sex life. It wasn't that, I mean, like I said, Ken didn't have friends. He didn't talk to anybody. And people actually said in some of their statements that we didn't want to know. Nobody's asking her, but she would just tell us. And we'd say, listen, we don't even want to know about this. It's like, and Melanie also, in one of her statements, you know, the 14-year-old daughter was like, you know, she's like, her parents were always just, you know, she's like, you just knew when they disappear into the room. And so they had a very, very active sex life. So yeah, I normally would not be something that would be, would matter, I think, in this investigation or any kind of investigation. But in this case, especially later, as the facts of the case kind of like open up, it'll become more apparent why that might have been a real factor in what actually happened to Sharon. So yeah, so it's not brought up randomly, but like I said, we're putting a pin in it and we'll get back to it later.
Keep a little mystery. I love that. Sarah, do you have a thought about that?
Well, yeah, I also will not blow up the mystery, but it actually is a very important part of her victimology.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I don't think it's insignificant that they would go to secluded, sandy places to have a dalliance, and she was found in such a place.
Yeah. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, when Carlene Webb told us that Sharon felt that she wasn't good enough for Kent, I mean, like, you know, as Sarah and I were listening to these folks talk about this, it was just like all the red flags of a classic abusive situation, mm-hmm. where the abuser has convinced their victim that they are unworthy, that they are, you know what I mean? Like it's part of the cycle of victimization, and nobody liked Ken. And I think part of Sharon telling people about their sex life was to get them to kind of like to give him credit for something, because there was literally nothing else she could give him credit for.
Yeah.
There was nothing else positive she could say to them. And so I think she thought this might make people be like, oh, okay, well, no wonder they're together. You know what I mean? Like, otherwise people were like, why is she with him? He was really, folks considered him kind of a loser.
Yeah. And you can't ask Sharon today, obviously, but one might also look at a certain thing in a different way. The idea that Ken shows up at her workplace and they run off together and have a romantic afternoon, it might also be viewed that he is there in a form of stalking or control, and that he is showing up at her workplace and demanding on some emotional level,
yeah.
that they go off and... Yeah. And we do something, and I take your paycheck and whatnot, right?
Yeah, one of the things, absolutely, 100%. He would call and check on her all the time when she was not. He knew her schedule, and when she was off schedule, even by a bit, he would start making phone calls, which is something he did not do the night she didn't come home. But you know, the question of who was the one demanding the sex, we're going to actually look at that a little closer in a later episode. We know Sexton in this episode said that. Sharon's sister said that, Sharon was the one that who always wanted it. But I think that might not have been the case. And I think we have some evidence to point the other way. And I also think, I think he might have had, Ken might have had multiple addictions, and sex addiction is a thing, you know. So, we've already talked a little bit about his gambling issues.
Right.
He seemed to probably, we're pretty sure he was an alcoholic. So this could have been one more addiction he was dealing with.
Robbie, so can you walk us through what everybody in the family had to say that day? Because you said the notifying investigators came in. There was an interesting reaction, I thought, among the children when Ken explained what had happened to Sharon. Walk us through that again, please.
Yeah, so the day after she disappeared, which would have been the 29th, you know, that morning is when the employee calls and convinces Ken to report her missing. A couple hours later, Sexton shows up to take a missing persons report. Maybe that's around 11, 12. It's not until much later that afternoon, like close to 5 p.m., that the police show up to tell them that she's died. But when Sexton came earlier, he noticed that Ken already seemed like just kind of off, weird. Sharon's brother arrived, and Sharon's brother also said that Ken's parents were already there, and everybody seemed to be in mourning. And he, at that point, Sharon was just missing. But according to what Ken and the girls told the police, their stories were fairly consistent in that they said the girls went out that night. They rode their bikes to their uncle's house, Ken Eaton, Sharon's brother's house, so that his wife could take him to Weight Watchers. They got home around 8:39. Nobody was home. Ken got home around 10. That's according to the girls. Ken himself said that he sent the girls out to go to the Weight Watchers thing, and then he went out. He kind of did some random stuff and did kind of nothing at the same time. He went to buy something from a hardware store, but he got to the store, didn't go inside, didn't buy it. Then he went to a CVS to look for greeting cards. This is not the kind of man that strikes me as somebody buying greeting cards, but he browsed the greeting cards but didn't buy anything. He came up with like three or four stops he made to account for his time. And then he told investigators he got home between 9 and 9:30. He didn't say 10. He said 9 and 9:30. And I think that he did that deliberately, that he, you know, the longer he's out, the more time he has to account for, right? So that's what they said. So that kind of lines up. Now it's on investigators to try to, how do they corroborate this, right? That he pulled up in front of a store and sat in his car and then drove away. Like, you can't really corroborate that.
No.
Yeah. But what was for sure is that Ken was alone and his time was not accounted for between 6 p.m. to about 10 p.m.
Sarah is one of the experts here. Anything about that, those interactions stand out to you? Any red flags?
I mean, pretty much the same red flags. One, that he's just flat out not honest. Two, that it is not only the perfect window for the, you know, for the time of death and for when she appears to have gone missing. But, you know, as you know, Robbie and I drove the route and it actually works out beautifully for him to have made all of the stops, you know, that would have been required for him to have been the doer. And just, you know, it does seem interesting that the places he names, he doesn't have, well, you know, I went here, but I didn't go in. And then I went here and I just looked around, but I didn't buy anything. Again, you know, it's 1988. So it's not like we've got, you know, red light cameras and security cameras in every parking lot, you know, structure like we have now. But you know, if you'd been in those places, somebody would have been able to alibi you. Somebody would have, for all those multiple places. And he was setting himself up in advance to say, well, I was there, but there's nobody you can go ask to prove that because it was so fleeting. And again, I think this is just, I just keep picturing this guy trying to like sweep up muddy prints behind him. That's how I pictured the entire like first couple of weeks after the night of, and then the first couple of weeks after the murder is Ken just constantly going around with a broom trying to sweep up his footprints, but like making new footprints behind him the whole way.
Right. And that actually reminds me of another detail that came up, which was the mud on his car, which, look, you know, if this were April in New Hampshire, which we call mud season, that would be very easily explained. If it were February and March, where there's salt and sand all over the roads and it gets all up on your wheel wells, that could be explained. Even though there had been rain, it was July, and unless someone, you know, was really going off road, you're really not going to get that dirty, right?
I mean, it was something that the officers noticed. If this was happening to every car in the area because the conditions are just like that, then but clearly that's not what was happening. It was something that every officer who saw the car specifically noticed. I also want to point one other thing out about how Ken is trying to frantically, you know, put together a story that will fly but also cover his butt, is that not only did he say he was – that he put himself in places that couldn't be accounted for specifically, like, you know, probably nobody could alibi him. At the same time, he was cognizant of the fact that he might have been seen in those areas. So he didn't say that he went to these towns that were nowhere close to where she was killed. He said that he went to Manchester, which is the mall that she probably went to. And he said he went to Bedford, which is where her body was found. Like, he literally puts himself there, I think, thinking, in case somebody saw me there, I can say, yeah, I told you I was there. I went to the CVS or whatever, right? Like, so he's also trying to cover his tracks that way, you know, he which means he's smarter than you think, because he didn't say, well, I was nowhere. I don't know, pick a town in New Hampshire. I was like 20 miles away in the other direction, right?
He's too clever by half, though. That's the thing, is I think he thinks that in doing that, he's going to outsmart everybody. He's like, aha, this is brilliant, because this way I can just say I was at the store in Bedford. When in reality, it's just so much more obvious to anybody looking at it.
You guys drove around the state. I'd point out that if you live in Bow, the place you would go to do this, you know, incidental shopping would be the city of Concord, of which Bo is, you know, is on the border with. And I don't know what stores were around and what time of day it would have been in the late 1980s. But to get to Manchester and Bedford, you would go through two toll booths and, you know, throw your tokens in. It's not as convenient to go get, you know, like you wouldn't drive for a half an hour to get a greeting card. You know what I'm saying? So, again, I feel like, you know, we are not doing a two-episode season of a whodunit of Undisclosed. This is all obviously going someplace, and we have to note that the title is State versus Jason Carroll, who we still haven't heard about yet. And this is so fascinating to me. Of course, I know how this ends up, but you continue to tease us with the idea that there is somebody else who isn't in the frame yet while all this is going on with Mr. Ken Johnson. Robbie, are you going to you know, reveal give us the big reveal soon?
Well, we have to go. This is just how I work. I go in the order that the investigation went.
Right.
I'm basically showing people this is what was happening at the time so that when we get to Jason Carroll, everybody will be as goddamn as confused as I was when we get to Jason Carroll. Because it's not like they nabbed Jason first or they thought or Jason was an initial suspect and then all of these things emerged later. This is all happening in real time. And somehow this ends up leading to Carroll, and not just Carroll, another co-defendant who we're also going to talk about too. But they have to actually first get through the other co-defendant to get to Carroll. So Ken might be our first suspect. He's not the last. There's a second one. And then we get to Carroll, believe it or not. But I'm taking folks through just through it, like as it kind of chronologically went along, because I think that's the best way to explain the case. And also, so that the audience can join me in understanding and seeing everything that the police were seeing at the time. And right. yet we end up with Jason Carroll. So, but no, we're going to get there. But
yeah, I feel that's why this is such a rich case to dive into is because of these things. Can we take a question from the internet?
We can take all the questions you want, yep.
All right, this is Kate from Twitter. She wants to know, was Sharon's car found?
Yeah, Sharon's car is going to be found, and in fact, it will be found in episode 3.
All right, let's not jump too far ahead, mm-hmm. Kate. This is also from Sarah. After listening to last week's addendum about the rings on the ground, I thought it is possible she was wearing them on a necklace. And that was broken, so they ended up on the ground. Pregnant women often wear rings like that because of swollen fingers. Someone else jumped in. Yeah, that's a very good point. I wonder if she'd taken them off to show the relationship was over. The rings are not an insignificant clue, right?
Yeah, you know, this is something Sarah and I talked about for a while. We're like, what are the different scenarios? And this was actually not a scenario I had considered, that she might have been wearing them on a necklace. Melanie, in fact, mentioned to an investigator about a week after, I think, the murder, that her mom might have sometimes worn a gold chain. There was no chain found there, which had it been, I would have been more inclined to think that's what I would immediately maybe have jumped to this theory. But it doesn't mean she wasn't. And thank you to our listeners who have raised this question, because I'm now going to take a look and see if we can talk to some people and say, Did she ever do that? It makes sense to me. She's towards the end of her pregnancy. It's summer. I know what it's like. Your fingers swell up. And that could explain it better than the theories we had, which is number one, she voluntarily removed them and threw them. Like, that didn't make sense to me. Number two, they came off during the struggle, which might have made sense, but only if they were all that loose, you know, or her fingers actually hadn't swollen, because not all women swell up that mm-hmm. way. Really, they don't. Not all women do. And some women do, but they don't until like the very last 2 weeks or something, you know? So we weren't quite sure. So I'm going to actually explore that. I'm going to see if we can talk to some folks and find out if that might explain what the rings were doing on the ground.
I have
and
never...
Sarah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, jump in with any of your thoughts.
Well, I was going to say, I definitely at some point said something about the necklace, but I may have said it to myself because I do remember, as you know, my pregnancy was rife with preeclampsia, which means a ton of swelling. And so I did think about that. And I actually, this is one of the tiny little places where Rabia and I may be little tiny ways. I can very much see a scenario that ends in her death and includes taking off the rings and throwing them at him. So that, you know, and I do think, I mean, even when you're not swollen, wedding rings are usually not, you know, not easy to pry off. They fit well for a reason usually. So I don't think there's a chance that all the rings, I can see the watch being, you know, coming off in a struggle, but not rings. And I think the necklace thing I think is definitely worth exploring. Although I agree with you, we didn't see anything that stated there was a necklace at the scene. That doesn't mean there wasn't one there that got crushed in the dirt or that it didn't get ripped off and take, you know, I mean, there are different reasons
that got caught, could have got caught in the shirt that disappeared. Right. I mean, like there's right.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. There's a bunch of different ways that that could go. I think it's one of those two things. She already either had them off on a necklace or she took them off because there was an argument.
Was she, remind me, 7 months pregnant? Is that right?
Yeah.
I have never carried a child, which is a surprise to you. But I would imagine that at 7 months that you don't always feel super sexy. Hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, your thoughts about a guy who may be coercive in that way or at least come to expect, a certain some romance. Mm-hmm. Whether or not, you know, just the, you know, I really not the mood kind of thing, if that might add some tension to the relationship.
Well, especially if they'd just had relations earlier that same day, that afternoon.
No, but they didn't. He actually said that they had lunch together. A couple of folks stopped by the car, but they actually had not hooked up that day.
They were rudely interrupted.
Yeah, if you're thinking you're getting your booty call and you don't. You know, you can lash out at different people for that. And I don't know. I feel like that may also be, something to think about there as to why tonight? Why this day? Why this evening? Was it something that happened earlier in the day? And again, if we're talking about going to sandy places to get it on, it's just too much of a coincidence, I think, that she's found there.
And I want to talk a little bit about the condition that she's found in, which is that her shirt's gone, her maternity pants are unbuttoned. However, she has actually not been raped or sexually assaulted. Her pants didn't come off, her underwear didn't come off. It almost seems like maybe it's possible she removed the shirt herself because she's making out because something's going to happen. The pants get unbuttoned, but then it never gets there.
Right.
And if that happened in someone's car and they took off, well, there goes the shirt too, right? Like there goes her purse too, because if she's in a car with somebody else who took her there and that's what they were doing, you know? So that's one explanation for it basically. But anyway, there in terms of, you know, If Ken is our prime suspect, you know, would it have been enough that he didn't get a booty call? He flies into a rage. I don't think so. There's a lot more that's we're going to talk about that was going on in his life that explains more about why he had every motive to do this. Why he might have thought he had the motive to do this, right? Like, so well.
It seems like you guys really lucked out with Detective Sexton. And the one thing that he said was that I've done, you know, hundreds of interviews, and this one stuck out to me. After all this time, right? You know, decades later. So I think would you say that, you know, Sarah, if somebody talks to people and tries to evaluate their honesty and then everything like that, that was good that he remembered that would be, those details would be really accurate?
Oh, absolutely. Especially at this stage. I mean, that case was, you know, 33 years ago and he was well into a very busy career already at that point and had, continued to have a busy career for long afterwards. And so for, you know, for all of that, you know, those filing cabinets in your head, for this one to be like, oh, there's this red folder that just jumps out at me every time I think about my past. You know, I mean, I only did the kind of traditional cop stuff for 10 years, but even in that, I have a handful of incidents or a handful of cases that will never leave me. And, you know, those there are just some that are different. And I think the fact that this one, you know, was one of those that for him was just different. I think it says a lot. And he, there are a lot of reasons to be frustrated with the state of American policing as it has been and has it, you know, continues to be. And I count myself among the people who's very frustrated with the state of American policing. But Tom Sexton, I think, is one of the people who went into it for the right reasons. He tried to, you know, continue to live his whole career for the right reasons. And even today, when we spoke to him, you know, he said to me as I was like leaving his driveway, he said, I want to help in any way I can. And, you know, that sticks out to me too. And so I trust the word of a man like that who says this one was just different and this guy's behavior was wrong.
So we have episode 3 coming up. You did a little tease. Rabia, give us again a little reminder, or just a little hint about what we're going to be hearing in that episode.
Well, I mean, this episode ends with Ken's car being towed and what they found in the car, which was a knife, among and a Sears receipt. And one thing I wonder about is, like, I know Sharon loved to shop at Sears. Did Ken like to shop at Sears? I don't know.
Who doesn't like shopping at Sears, Rabia?
I mean, I Ken, I think, but I could be wrong here.
And they got Ken Moore appliances. They got Craftsman tools. Come on.
This is true. This is true. And he did like his tools and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, in the next episode, we're just going to kind of pick up in those couple of days because, you know, the first 3, 4, 5 days are very important in terms of figuring out what happened, but also in the state's case later, you know, when they take Jason to trial and they have to prosecute somebody for this crime. They have a theory that they lay out about what happened in those days. And so, well, we got to first ourselves understand what happened according to the documents we have. So in the next episode, we're going to talk more about just, you know, how Sharon's car being found, how it was found, where it was found, the questions that raised. What was Ken doing in the days after the murder? Because, you know, like Sarah said, Ken is just like making new footprints as he's cleaning up old ones. And so we're going to continue to follow the story.
Great. Sarah Kalin, thank you for joining us on The Addendum.
Thank you for having all of us.
Yeah, your doggies too.
The dogs have started again.
I think your dogs contributed more than I actually did. So that's great. And Rabia, thanks again for having me on and for explaining a little more about what we heard in episode 2.
Thanks for being an awesome host of The Addendum, Kevin. Appreciate it.
So if you have any questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Talan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.